Welcome to Everything STEAM. I'm your host, Sam Stanford. As a physicist and structural engineer with Jacobs Engineering, I've made many connections with some bright individuals who are either working, studying, or self-taught and passionate about our particular topics of discussion. In this episode, we plan to talk about a field in science that has exponentially progressed since it was founded in the mid to late 1800s by Gregor Mendel. This field is, of course, genetics. Once we get through some of the basics like DNA, genome sequencing, gene expression, and epigenetics, we'll highlight the exponential growth of this field by discussing a very exciting, practical, and ethically challenging method of genetic editing called CRISPR-Cas9 that has profound implications of curing our fellow humans from diseases such as sickle cell anemia. If you've listened to one of my podcasts before, you know that this is not in my wheelhouse, so I brought in a lovely guest that is well-equipped in this realm. So without further delay, let me introduce you to Brenna Stanford. Brenna is a molecular ecologist working on her PhD at the University of Calgary, Alberta. She grew up on a small island on the West Coast where she developed a deep curiosity and love for the beautiful complexity of the natural world. In 2015, Brenna graduated with an honors degree in biochemistry from the University of Victoria and then worked as a conservation biologist for Parks Canada before starting graduate school. Over the last 7 years, Brenna has done research on a number of different species, broadly focusing on using molecular techniques to better understand how organisms respond to and adapt to their ever-changing environment. Brenna then completed an MSc in evolutionary biology in 2019, where she used whole genome sequencing to answer conservation questions for the endangered Banff Springs snail. Currently, she's near completion of her PhD, where Brenna has combined her passion for molecular processes and conservation by investigating the ecology of gene expression to test predictions about the resiliency of species to climate change. So, now that you've been introduced to Brenna and the topic of this podcast, we're going to head into the first segment where we plan to relay some basics in the field of genetics. Brenna, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Hello, I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm good. You know, it's kind of funny. Whenever I reached out to you on TikTok and we kind of had a back and forth, we didn't realize that both of our last names were Stanford until we met.
The joys of connecting with people on social media where you're not using your actual name.
I would really love to know the odds of like meeting someone in this kind of realm of science communication, just like, and having the same last name. I thought it was funny.
It was funny. I went to a conference last summer and there's a prominent lab in what I research at Stanford. And the person looked at my name and was like talking to me, thinking I was one of his grad students. And I was like, I don't know when to interject that, like, I don't go to Stanford. That's just my name. Oh. So it was very funny. I was like, oh no, I go to University of Calgary. And he's like, where?
That like institution bias runs way too deep.
Yeah. I mean, it's really more important about who your supervisor is.
Yeah, I agree with that. So we're talking about genetics. Before we get into anything like too surface level, then deeper later into the podcast, I want to start out by just asking you, why did you really get into biology? Was it just because you love Punnett squares or
what? Oh yeah, love me a good Punnett square. Just I was talking to my best friend actually a little while ago and she was like, I just don't know what you would have been if you weren't a scientist. It just, nothing else really makes sense for you. But I, as a common thing of students in biology, I thought I wanted to be a medical doctor. So I went to college, which, if there's anything you can get from this, college is a wonderful option for the first 2 years of your degree, at least in Canada. I don't know so much about in the United States, but I went and I had a wonderful program, applied chemistry and biotechnology. But then I took a second year biochemistry course with a phenomenal prof and I fell in love. And so when I transferred to university, I ended up doing a degree in biochemistry. And my parents have always been so supportive of whatever I want to do. But I think that this was the first thing that my mom was like, well, maybe you should just take the MCAT. And I was like, no, I really don't think I want to be a medical doctor anymore. Finished an undergrad, did an honors project where I studied the function of a gene, which we'll get into more about. But then realized I didn't want to study one protein for the rest of my life. So I took a bit of time off, was a ski bum for a little bit, and started a master's with Parks Canada doing whole genome conservation sequencing project in an endangered species. Through that project, met my current supervisor, and now I'm doing a PhD broadly looking at how species adapt and persist in their environment, and specifically as environment changes. I study that using a little species called the three-spined stickleback, and I don't know how nerdy this is, but got a little tattoo of the guy, a little species of fish. So that's currently where I'm at. I'm finishing up my PhD in this project and looking for postdocs. Yeah. I love DNA. I was learning about how like biochemical pathways worked and how DNA expression worked and all these things. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And everyone else around me is going, oh God, I can't wait for this course to be over. And I'm like, oh, so. It's amazing when you like go to university or like find the thing that like kind of clicks for you. And then like really being able to apply that in my current position to like ecological and evolutionary questions has just been a really wonderful fit.
Oh, 100%. So for this segment, we're going to maybe like start a foundation for our later topics. And we want to, I guess, address, I'll just direct it towards you because you're the expert. I'm not even going to attempt this, but we talked offset about starting this out by running through cell to DNA in stages. Mm-hmm. So take it away.
Okay. When we start talking about DNA, RNA, and all of these terms, it's important to kind of think about how this is packaged in your body. So your body has made up of a lot of different cells. And so what you have is cells that have been differentiated into different kinds. So you have skin cells, you've got like, for example, your muscle is made up of, I believe, like 13 different cell types. Wow. And so these are all stem cells that have been cued and have differentiated into these different types of cells that you need to make you. Because you can imagine that the job of an eyeball cell or a specific part of your eyeball is a very different job than your skin cell. So it needs different characteristics. And so stem cells are unprogrammed cells that sit there and then they get a cue from the environment and then they become a certain cell type. So that's important when we start talking about DNA, because the information to make all those different cell types and to create all those functions exists in every single one of your cells. But there are other factors that allow it then to become certain different types and have these different functions. When you kind of go into a actual just cell, I'm doing the like circle with my hand. like I'm sure that people have seen this. It's like, it's a circle like this. And then there's a little circle inside. And then there's some mitochondrial drawn and it's all very clean and unchaotic. That's not, of course, not what real biology looks like. I was frankly quite upset when I learned this. I was like, what do you mean? It's not this beautiful, clean little drawing we have. But the kind of two main structures that we'll talk about that's important for this conversation is that there's two kind of broad zones in a cell. There's the big, so there's your circle, and all of that in there is called the cytoplasm. And then on the inside, there's the smaller circle, which is called the nucleus. The nucleus has your DNA, and it's kind of like a vault, keeps your DNA, and not a lot of information is ever allowed to go into that area. Because as you can imagine, your DNA is very valuable. It's got the instructions of how to make everything that makes you function. So we got to protect that. And then the cytoplasm is where like all of the machinery, the mitochondria, ribosomes, and a bunch of other things exist. But there's these two kind of like, there's the membrane phospholipid bilayer that sits at the outside of your cell. So there's the outside of the cell, inside the cell, cytoplasm, and then your nucleus, which has your DNA in it. So that's kind of the structure of a cell for eukaryotes, which is what we'll talk about today.
Right. Yeah.
As cool as bacteria are, we're not gonna get into those today.
Right. I do want to kind of highlight this quick little fun fact. I think there's between 30 and 40 trillion cells at one time that make up the human body.
About right.
if you can think in terms of millions, which most people cannot, that is 30 million. Take that times 1,000 and times 1,000. And that's what you get.
That's
that's pretty crazy.
And that's just existing to make you you.
Right. And I think there's also that really cutesy, like, fun fact as well is, like, isn't it every 7 to 10 years your body completely cycles through all of its cells or something of that matter? Is that true?
I feel like you're really putting me on the spot here. I haven't looked that up. I feel like I just heard that when I was like a teen and was like, yeah, sounds about right. I feel like now I got to look it up.
Okay. Yeah. So do your research, fact check me, let me know.
But it sounds about right. Cause like your body is constantly, I think that actually is a really important point, is that your cells have a limited lifetime. Mm-hmm. And so your cells are copying themselves to make another cell to take its place, because then there's something called programmed cell death, where the cell is like, okay, I've lived a good run. We're going to kind of dismantle ourselves. We've made a new one. We're good. Then there's like unprogrammed cell death, which is kind of like a cell bursting, where it's a much more chaotic process. And it's generally based off of a reaction to something. Mm-hmm. And so when it's copying itself, you have to copy your DNA over. You've got to make an entire new copy of it. Your cell has really sophisticated machinery to like copy all of the DNA and do this in a really, like, as you could imagine, it could be easy to make mistakes. And I think that people don't quite understand, maybe that's unfair. I know that I was surprised to figure out just how big DNA is. Like, if we're just talking about humans, in every single one of those trillion cells you have 6.5 feet, about 2 meters. So it's this really, really thin string that's packaged into the nucleus of every single one of your cells. To kind of put that into perspective, if we consider it as like words, it would take someone typing 60 words per minute, 8 hours a day. It would take them 50 years to type out all the information that you have in one of your cells.
We want to just say on a base level for right now, if you were to cite the letters in the human genome, if you were to say one letter per second, you would be doing that for 209 years.
Oh my goodness. That's a great way to think about it.
It was 6.6 billion letters.
Well, if you consider dual copy, 3.2 billion.
Okay, I guess cut it in half. You're still at 104 and a half years.
Very feasible now.
Yeah, no worries. No worries. Just dedicate your whole life and...
Hope that you live over 100.
Right. Right. Which not most of us can do.
Well, not yet. We'll get into more about CRISPR. So.
Exciting. So you had a really interesting analogy, I think, that you were getting to whenever you were talking about the nucleus being the vault of the cell. So would you mind jumping into that a little bit more?
And I realized I kind of jumped ahead about talking about letters of DNA. Mm-hmm. So DNA is made up of 4 different molecules that we consider. So it's A, T, C, and V. And this is the name for the molecules of it. And so DNA is structured in different combinations of these letters. So if you kind of zoomed into that 6.5 feet or 2 meters of DNA. I don't know why I keep using feet. You zoomed in to a small region and looked at the letters of it. It would be something, maybe it would be like AA, T, G, CCC, and it would be different combinations of these. Mm-hmm. And those different combinations code information, and it's different information depending on the order in which these letters are. That is going to get important when we start talking about genes. The A, T, C's, and G's, I like to think of it kind of like a huge, huge instruction manual that is all of the instructions on how to build and run a human. And obviously this can get expanded to an organism of any kind, but I feel like we're talking mostly about humans. So it's how to build and how to continue functioning this human. If we think about like a human or a species or an organism as like a house, it has how to lay the foundation, when to build the walls, the fact that you need to build the walls before you do any of the inside framing, put the roof on. My dad's a carpenter. So Oh, fantastic. So it has all of that information in it, and that sits in the vault. But as you kind of think, you don't need all of that information all of the time. So, and if we think about it, maybe if we think your eyeball is a window, you need glass panes, you need how to like make a little frame, you need to know all of these things, but you don't need to know how to build a kitchen table to build a window. But all that information of how to do everything is in every single one of your cells. So that is sitting in the vault, all of that information. What happens is that there will be in your cell a little cue that says, hey, I think we need to build a window. And so through a series of kind of telephone signal transduction, so goes through the outside membrane of the cell and goes through the cytoplasm through a bunch of communication, it hits the front desk of the nucleus, the vault, and it says, hey, I got a request. I need to make a window. And the secretary is like, I got you. Or I guess the librarian. I don't know. We're mixing analogies at this point. And it goes to the giant instruction manual and it flips through and it finds the instructions on how to build the frame of a window, how to source glass. It makes a bunch of different copies of it, like photocopies that region. And then it brings back, because it like, are you going to give someone the entire thing, all 2 meters of it, or like this huge book? Or just the specific instructions. So you give the specific instructions, that gets slid back over the desk, and that now goes into the cytoplasm, where there's machinery on how to build everything that you need. And so if we consider the vault that contains DNA in that space, so like the instruction manual is the DNA, those little photocopies is what we would consider RNA. So it's the instructions that have been copied from the DNA that now go into the cytoplasm and that are specific for certain functions and how to build very specific things rather than all of the instructions on how to build a human and run it. I don't know if that made any sense. I'm hoping.
I think that's a really great analogy, honestly, like for a layperson. Do we also want to cover what RNA is with respect to DNA, like in terms of how they're structured?
So DNA is packaged in what we call a double helix. The double helix is, if we consider like one side of the double helix, it's an A, a T, a G, let's say. A binds T on the other side. So it would be a complementary strand. So they bind across and then they twist and they create this double helix shape. And that's packaged into chromosomes, into your nucleus. Because remember, you got to package 2 meters of this stuff into a very small region. So that's also like part of what the DNA, when the little memo comes and says, hey, we need this instruction, it goes through, files through all of that 2 meters and finds the region that has that instructions and actually opens it up, basically breaks apart the A and T from each other, makes it open, and then it copies that into RNA. And so the RNA is actually only single-stranded. It doesn't have a complementary pair. It also has a different base. So it has a U in it.
Instead of the T, so, right?
Yeah. And so that kind of comes off of the DNA. This gets sealed back up. It's very stable when it's bound to itself. And we like that because we don't want to damage our DNA in any way. But then the RNA floats back out of the nucleus into the cytoplasm. And it gets read and built into whatever it needs to be built. And then because it's a little bit unstable, because it's in this single-stranded state, and also because there's some things, it gets degraded. Once you've built the window, you don't need the instructions to build the window sitting around, taking up space. And so it gets degraded, and then the parts of it gets recycled into making a new RNA.
Makes sense. That's pretty cool. One cute saying for the base pairs in the double helix is apple in the tree, so A and T, and then car in the garage, C and G. I think.
Oh, that's precious.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay.
I never heard that.
Oh, there you go. Gosh.
I'm going to use that with my students.
Yes. There we go. I learned that forever ago, and it has just kind of stuck in my brain for some reason. Whenever I was getting ready for this podcast, it came back to me, and I'm just like I have to use this.
Well, thank you for sharing. I very much appreciate it, because it's, I don't know, it's like always nice to like have things that make it a little bit clearer for people to remember. It is complicated, and it's something that, I mean, I've been learning about for 13 years now, and I'm still like, okay, sometimes, you know, so it's great.
Okay, so I think moving on, we talked about the base pairs, nucleotides, mm-hmm. is that right? Is that the mm-hmm. right term for them? Mm-hmm. So we have, okay, so the nucleotides, which, you know, apple in the tree, car in the garage, yeah. and then we go to DNA, and then we take a step up from that, and yeah. we're at genes. So mm-hmm. what is a gene?
Well, that is a loaded question, actually. In one of my undergrad courses, we had a conversation, what is a gene? And it was sparked a debate, which I think is interesting when we think about language use in science, because a lot of the time we use the same terms and we have slightly different opinions or ideas that brings it up. So my background is biochem, as I've mentioned, and I work with a bunch of ecologists, and we have different ideas about molecular. Anyways, that didn't answer your question at all. So a gene, traditionally, and you'll hear me sometimes maybe say a protein coding gene. So traditionally, a protein coding gene is what was considered a gene. So you may have heard the thing of like, oh, 98% of your genome is junk if you're of a certain generation. And this was the kind of theory until I think probably 15 years ago, is that it was called junk DNA, anything that didn't code for a protein. So when I say code for a protein, going back to our building a house analogy, and where we were just talking about copying certain regions. So what I was talking about with that is what we would consider a protein coding gene. Mm-hmm. So the memo, or like the photocopied instructions, go out into the cytoplasm, and then machinery, which is called a ribosome, clips on, and it reads every three base pairs, mm-hmm. and that links amino acids together in a certain mm-hmm. sequence. That sequence of amino acids then folds and becomes a protein mm-hmm. that has a function. Only 2% of your genome codes for proteins. The other 98% doesn't code for those. But what we've increasingly found out is that that 98% is incredibly important for when and where that 2% is turned on or turned off. So like when a human is developing, there has to be signals that tells the cells to be skin, to create this body plan. And so that is a really sophisticated system. A large component of that other 98% is regulating when and where that 2% is turned on and off, when those photocopied memos get made mm-hmm. and under what conditions. And so this is kind of a fascinating thing, is that when we look more broadly and we look at genome size, so 3.2 billion base pairs, humans, and we look at complexity, mm-hmm. there's almost no correlation between the amount of protein coding genes and complexity of an organism or genome size. There's plants like conifers that have 10 times the size of the genome of us, if not wow. more. I think the biggest genome is a Japanese plant. Wow. It has like, I'm trying to do some quick math, like 80 times the size of a genome of ours. But when you start looking at regulation, that's when more regulation correlates with complexity of an organism. Oh. So when and where things are turned on and off. So how much control do we have on the development of an organism? And so that's correlated with complexity, which I think is super cool, because I love epigenetics and I love regulation of genes and things like that. So a gene, most traditionally, though, is a protein coding region of the genome, and it is made into a very specific type of RNA called messenger RNA. Mm. And there's other regions of the genome that get made into functional RNA products, but they don't get made into a protein.
That's really cool. And I did not know that it was such a low percentage, but it didn't like mean that the 98% was useless. That's super cool.
Yeah. It's distinctly not useless, but I remember learning about it before I started university, and there was a lot of people talking about junk DNA. And that's just not the case as we figure out what it does. It definitely has a function. It just doesn't code for a protein.
Just stemming off of that, I'm curious, how different is my DNA versus your DNA?
It's only about 0.1% of the genome that is variable between individuals, which is crazy when you think about like the variation between it. But it's important to remember that 0.1% when you're talking about 3 billion bases is a substantial amount of variation. And so what do I mean when I'm talking about variation? So I'll introduce the kind of classic, which is mutations or base pair differences. So what that would mean is that in a region of the genome that is the same region between you and me, if we scanned across it, let's say there was a base pair where you have an A and I have a G, that would be what we consider a single nucleotide polymorphism known as SNPs. Okay. So that is a variant between you and me. So like an example of that would be, for example, I can't actually see what your eye color is.
They go between blue and green.
Okay, blue and green, but you have light colored eyes. So both you and I have light colored eyes. And so when we talk about eye color, broadly what we can sort them into is dark eyes, light eyes. And then there's obviously the variance between like green, blue, hazel, and things that control kind of color within those things. But if we just think broadly, light and dark, there are genetic mutations in a specific gene that regulates the amount of melanin that you have in your eye. And so people who have light colored eyes broadly have certain genetic variants in that gene. And people with dark eyes have different variants in that gene. Because biology is complicated and we love this like very simple story about eye color, I was doing some reading before this podcast because I just wanted to make sure. There's a bunch of other variants in different genes. There's also an environmental factor. There's a bunch of things that do change eye color that makes it not just a single gene that codes whether or not you have light color or dark colored eyes. But this is one of the genes that contributes the most to determining whether or not you have dark or light colored eyes. We talk about sometimes how much of the variation in this trait can be explained by a single gene or a couple of genes, and a large amount of the variation between people can be explained by mutations in this specific gene, but not all of it, because biology is complicated and messy and
of course
all sorts of things. It's the things that keep me so excited about what I do, but also keep me up at night. So when we think about variants in protein coding genes, means that the memo has like a different word in the instructions. So when that instruction gets built, the structure of the protein is going to be slightly different because there was a slightly different set of instructions. And a protein that has a bit of a different structure is going to have a slightly different ability to function, or when and where it functions or things like that. And that's what can create variation in what we see for phenotypes. So when I say a mutation in a gene, that could be one way. It also could be in the regulation of that protein. Mm-hmm. So let's say it's in the when and where that gene gets turned on. So when it gets copied, there can be mutations in that regulation, and that can also generate variation that we see. So it's not always just mutations that affect the protein structure. It can also be mutations that change when and where that protein is made. So that is what we would consider like regulatory changes.
Okay.
But that, yeah, and those can both be at the genetic sequence level.
Okay. Yeah. So that's the genetic sequence level that brings forth variance between organisms, or I guess variance between
individuals cells. Of the same, like the same organism, same species.
Yeah.
But it also can be like, sometimes when we're looking at evolutionary history, we can look at genetic variance between species that explains why they diverged, how they diverged. So there's like the idea that like genetic variance cropped up, it resulted in slightly different phenotypes. Maybe that allowed them to occupy slightly different ecological niches. And then they started diverging because they became very adapted to that specific niche. And we can see that in their genome. We can see genetic variation between these, let's say, like recently diverged species, and go, oh, like that's what controls these phenotypic differences that we see in these species.
That's really interesting. And I think that's a great way to conclude the first segment, because when we come back, we're going to talk about gene expression with respect to the environment. So it's a different way that creates, you know, mutation and things like that. So we'll talk about that when we come back.
Are you an athlete who is constantly on the grind? Maybe you're a student who's cramming for an 8 a.m. exam the next day. Or maybe you're someone who's crushing a hike and you have three peaks to go. Well, you've come to the right ad. Sigma snacks are a healthy alternative to pre-workout and energy drinks. These snacks deliver easily digestible sugars and carbs necessary to crush an early morning workout, late night study sesh, or any adventure in between. By combining caffeine and the amino acid L-theanine, these bars are backed by scientific research to provide clean energy, extra focus, and reduce the anxiety and crash that are associated with normal pre-workout and junk energy drinks. Not to mention, they taste great. Specifically, I have been taking them with me on my backpacking adventures. They're a great way to start the day without having any jitters or an upset stomach on the trail. Lastly, Sigma Snacks is a student-run, student-operated startup that would like to offer you 15% off your first purchase with the promo code STEAM. So head on over to eatsigmasnacks.com and order your first Sigma snack today to have the best and most reliable source of energy shipped right to your door. That's eatsigmasnacks.com, promo code STEAM for energy that's out of this world.
Okay, we're back. This is segment two, and we're going to talk about gene expression with respect to the environment. But before we get there, we want to add a couple things, because Brenna feels like it's very important, and I totally agree. Talking offset a little bit, I'm a little checked out because I'm not feeling well, but Brenna explains it very well. I promise you, it makes total sense. It's me. So we want to talk about genetic sequence changes. So Brenna, I'm going to leave you off with that.
Yeah. So when we think of evolution and we think of natural selection, mostly what we're talking about, and we're really thinking about kind of classic Darwinism, is genetic changes. So sequence changes. So we both have light colored eyes. I'm going to use this example again. But with someone with dark eyes, they have genetic differences in this gene. Let's say they have let's bring it back to Punnett squares. They have offspring with someone that has light-colored eyes. Mm-hmm. There is an opportunity for the genetic information from them and the genetic information from their partner to combine. So there's probability if they, let's say, have the brown type of the gene, and then they also have the blue, because maybe they have one copy of each. Mm-hmm. And their partner has two copies of the blue. There's combinations that their offspring will have dark eyes because it's dominant. So if you have one copy, you're going to have dark eyes. Or they might inherit both of the like little blue. Mm-hmm. And so that's one gene, one thing. But this is happening across your genome with variation. It's getting shuffled every time you have offspring. Traditionally, we had thought of evolution really just from this genetic change perspective. And every once in a while, mutations occur in an individual. And that has to happen in germline cells. So there's your somatic cells, which make you, and then there's your germline cells. So talking egg and sperm. Mm-hmm. For a genetic mutation to be introduced, to have a function in evolution, it has to occur in your germline, because it needs to be able to be passed on to offspring. And so that happens relatively infrequently, because the machinery that copies your DNA and does all that is really good at copying it and checks it over and over and over again and tries to fix any mistakes that it made. Only every once in a while does a genetic mutation occur in a germline. And that is what can get exposed to natural selection and evolution. However, there's also something that's really hit the forefront now and like really taken the world by storm. It's something called epigenetics. And so these are changes that alter when and where your genes are turned on or turned off that don't impact the genetic sequence. So these are changes that can happen that are above epi, above genome. I don't know if I should just keep rambling about this.
No.
Is there any questions?
No, that's perfect. I think everything's being explained quite well. Epigenetics then is influence based on behavior and environmental stresses.
Yeah. So there's kind of, again, this is another one of these terms that there's about over 20 different definitions of what epigenetics means, depending on what field you're in what regard. So the way that I was taught about it is that it's above the genome. So changes that alter the regulation of your DNA that have to be inheritable. In kind of recent years, that has gotten altered to anything that is not a genetic change that can change the way that your DNA is regulated. That can happen within your lifetime. So they're reversible and they can happen across generations as well. And there's been quite a bit of debate about the transgenerational aspect of epigenetics. But there's like some cool studies when I was an undergrad that I just thought was so neat. So they took rats. You can have genetically identical rats. Their DNA sequence is exactly the same. They exposed some of the male rats to a scent cue, and then they stressed them out. They did this over and over and over again to the point that the male rats would smell the scent cue and kind of be like on edge.
Mm-hmm.
They had their control group that they didn't do this treatment to. Then they made crosses. So they made a second generation. They used the sperm from these stressed, not stressed male mice, and they crossed them and made a generation of mice or rats with these two types, with genetically the same mom. And what they found is that the second generation, the mice or the rats that had the sperm from the stressed out individual also responded to that environmental cue. They would be startled from that scent cue. The male mouse had never met their offspring. These are all controlled crosses. So it's not as if the male mouse was like, took its offspring aside and was like, you need to watch out for this scent. It's bad. Right. It was something in the like regulation of DNA that had been passed on by not a genetic change. It's crazy. And so what they found is that there was actually a change in the regulation of a gene that is related to stress response. So it was a different pattern of regulation, but it was not a genetic change. There was no changes in the actual DNA sequence. There was just changes in how that gene was regulated. And so it's like these little markers, epi above genome. My work looks at gene regulation differences that can get cued by early life history. I don't know if I can talk about my PhD work specifically. So what I did was I took families of stickleback, the little fish, and I raised their eggs at different temperatures. So everything else was kept the same. Everything was kept the same. Just raise them at different temperatures, because what we're curious about is how does an environmental stressor, a temperature stress, affect adulthood? Can they be raised at these different temperatures and has no long-term consequences? Maybe. Or maybe does this stress at early life have long-term repercussions into adulthood? And so what we did is we raised them at these different temperatures that represent their thermal limits, and then we switched them back to all the same temperature once they hatched. So the only thing that was different in the lifetime of these organisms was what temperature their eggs were reared at. And as an adult, I actually took their RNA. So I extracted tissue and I isolated all of their mRNA from that. So I basically quantified and determined which copies of the memos were active at any point.
Nice.
And what I have found is that early life history actually changes what genes they have active into adulthood. So there's this signature that there's no genetic change because it's within the lifetime of an organism. There's no genetic change. But there are changes in the way that the DNA is being read and turned on and off, which I think is pretty cool. It's just important to think about the differences between genetic changes that can occur, if bringing it back to like genetic changes that occur in somatic cells versus germline cells. Because if you get cancer, that's, unless it's in specific areas, that's not going to affect future generations.
Got it. Oh, that's interesting.
Because there's genetic changes occurring, but it's isolated. unless it's in reproductive areas.
What kind of cues from the environment other than like for example, what about like UV light exposure or maybe even high energy or high energy radiation, like say X-ray or a gamma ray or something random like that? Or I guess we usually think of like high energy radiation whenever you think of like stressors.
So I think like that is also because that does introduce potential opportunities for mutations. That it would be actual genetic changes that can occur with mutations. And that's when we think about cancer, like exposure to things that can cause genetic changes. That can have obviously very, even if we're not talking about evolution, that has very distinct health consequences for an individual. Mm-hmm. Because a certain region or a certain tissue type might get mutated. And that results in, I mean, if I'm just speaking with cancer, unchecked cell growth. There's a lot of regulatory components that monitor when a cell gets duplicated and when it makes another copy and how it behaves, that keeps everybody in check. And when mutations occur in that regulatory system, we can get this unchecked replication of cells. And that can result in things like cancer. Mutations from like the examples that you used here do have consequences for an individual because those genetic mutations can break basically the machinery that checks that everything's happening correctly. So it can introduce mutations that make it no longer function or not function the way it's supposed to. And that has really big problems. And when I talk about though, like environmental cues, it doesn't have to be anything nearly as drastic as that when we talk about kind of just being alive. So for example, like this morning, I woke up, great first step to the day, drink some coffee. You know, I'm sitting on this podcast, I'm gonna go for a run later. These need different states of my being. And those different states need different machinery. They need different proteins, they need different things. Like going back to our house analogy, let's say, going for a run is an environmental cue that you're going to have guests over. And you're looking around your house and you're like, we do not have enough chairs for all these people that we're going to have over. And so then you get a cue saying, we're going to have guests over. And so then you make a whole bunch of the photocopied memos on the instructions on how to build chairs. And you make a whole bunch of chairs for when the guests come over. In just like your living room, which will be like your muscles, let's say. So then you go for your run, you come back. In our analogy here, all the guests leave. And you're like, oh man, I don't need all these chairs. But what now I need to do is I need to make something else. So you dismantle all of those chairs. And then it becomes the wood that could be made into something else. And so the environmental cue doesn't have to be anything super drastic. It can just be being alive. Because you need different states of being to be able to track even the change that occurs within your day. So there can be changes that occur over your lifetime. As you can think, like a baby needs different information, different processes turned on and off than like as you're going into puberty. Very drastic changes. So the environmental cues and the internal cues as well, it's not just environment, internal cues, say like, hey, we're going to go through some pretty drastic changes. We're going to need to turn on this, turn off that, do this. Mm-hmm. And then you go into adulthood and this aspect. And then you grow older. And there's different internal and environmental cues as that happens. So that's like over the lifetime. There's also within your day. Or like if you eat a big meal, your body needs to be able to respond to that. Right. And so what's happening constantly is that your cells and your different cell types are getting information and making different proteins that are necessary to be able to handle what is changing here. And that's what I'm really interested in. How do organisms, species react to their environment at a molecular level?
That's amazing. Before we close out on this segment, I kind of want to pick your brain a little bit. I mean, we kind of already laid the groundwork for this, and this is probably a dumb question now. With how drastic the climate has changed within the last 100 and so many years. What are you seeing in your field?
This is what's like so interesting about it is that why we're interested in the work that we're doing right now is that how rapid climate change is occurring is that it's exposing organisms to environments that are outside of their historic range, because evolution is really good at making organisms match their environment if it is given enough time.
Of course.
Because genomic, or as we were talking about, mutations happen quite infrequently. And the majority of mutations that occur are going to mess up systems. Something that I always say is that there's 1,000 ways to break a race car. There's very few ways to make it better. And so most of the changes that occur genetically are going to kind of mess things up. So you're waiting for the one thing that's going to make it better. That being said, there's also just natural variation that happens in the environment. As you're saying, we have 0.1% of variation between humans. Sometimes when the environment changes really rapidly, something that was evolutionarily neutral, so variation between us, let's say we find out that the environment changes rapidly and light eyes are incredibly better than dark eyes. Oh, that's already variation that we have in the population. So maybe this starts getting selected for, the light eye phenotype. And so that can be kind of the two ways. What we're seeing now with climate change and what we're getting interested in is ways that species and organisms can respond to their environment within their lifetime or within a couple of generations. So this might not be genetic changes, and this doesn't have to even be molecular, it might be behavior changes. We're seeing in certain areas, species are switching to more nocturnal. They're switching because humans are less present on the landscape at night. And so they're changing their behavior in response to this. And so we can see what we're getting kind of what we're interested in is understanding at how species might be able to rapidly respond to the environmental change, because it's not happening on the time scale that we would expect traditional evolution or response, basically. Like, it's challenging their ability to track the changes because it's happening so quickly.
Right. It's a drastic event relative to what, and I caution myself on how I want to state this, because there's always the people on the other side of the fence that are looking for a single word to point, you know, to point fingers. In terms of natural cyclic approach to climate, this is a drastic event. And so it's challenging a wide variety of organisms.
And it's the time. It's how much change has happened over a very short amount of time. Like, we consider recent evolution 10,000 years. That's very recent evolution. Like, the little species of fish that I study, there's a freshwater and there's a marine type. They diverged about 10,000 years ago. The example of this divergence is considered very recent evolution. So we think about evolution across 10,000 years is considered very recent. And then we look at the changes that have happened in 200 years. The ability of species and ecosystems to buffer that change, they might have been able to do that if this had happened over 10, 20, 30,000 years, but it's not. It's happening over a blink of an eye. And so this is going to be challenging these ecosystems. And then they also are being challenged by loss of biodiversity, overfishing, fragmentation, logging, industry, all these things. So that they're really, it's not just climate change. It's a whole bunch of other host of things that are challenging an ecosystem to be able to function and species to be able to adapt. If I can use this little platform just for a moment, when we think about how ecosystems are changing, we should be concerned from not just like a feel good kind of way. Our economies, our function, our way of life rely on functioning ecosystems.
Yep.
We get a lot of services, wood. In BC, we had the wildfires, and then we had massive mudslides, took out entire roadways. These are services that we rely on from ecosystems.
Yep.
And it's trillions of dollars, if we're just thinking about it from that perspective. So we have a vested interest in maintaining biodiversity and maintaining ecosystem function. So that'll be my little plug, my little side.
I totally agree with that. And I think to have that simmer a little bit, we're going to jump into this next break. But when we come back, we're going to talk about CRISPR gene editing.
Hard switch.
I know, right? So let that sit, simmer, and we'll be back.
Have you ever been standing in the shower, looking at the ingredients on your shampoo bottle, and noticed that water is always the first ingredient? Well, I have. After a little research, I discovered that shampoo is over 80% water, which is kind of like dumping bottled water on your head while you're standing in a shower. And that's why I'm excited that I found C-Bar, a disposable plastic-free hair care line that cleans up ocean trash with every purchase. Not only does C-Bar pick up 1 pound of ocean trash for every item ordered, but their salon-quality shampoo and conditioner concentrates come from refillable applicators, kind of like deodorant tubes. Just twist them up, rub it on over your hair a couple times, and then just lather it up like you normally would. My favorite part is how long they last. I've personally been using the same C-Bar for 3 months now, and I've barely used any. So not only does it help save the environment, it's also effective, efficient, and most importantly, it saves me money. If you would like to try a better way to wash your hair, head on over to cbar.com and use our special code STEAM for 15% off your first order. C-Bar, shampoo done right for you and the planet.
Okay, well, this is segment 3. I'm sure you're hanging in here because it's been quite elegantly communicated. We've had some really cool fun facts, some great analogies, and it's really cool information. So I'm sure the people that are watching or listening to this are enjoying their science communication hunger, I guess. Or this part, in my opinion, is my favorite part because we don't typically talk ethics on this podcast. And it's just something that doesn't typically come up because, I don't know, just hasn't. And I like talking about ethics. And we'll get to that. Essentially, we're talking about CRISPR and gene editing. So I'm sorry, I might have confused people on why I just said ethics, but we'll get to that. What I do want to start with, though, is, Brenna, what is CRISPR? It's an acronym, but...
Yes. So broadly, it's a bacterial immune system. So it was discovered in bacteria because they have this ability to cut DNA when they get infected with something and then store that in their DNA. So it's a DNA editing system.
It's the tail between bacteria and viruses, and it's been something that's just been happening for a very, very, very long time.
And so scientists saw this thing where it's like, okay, so these bacteria have these systems, and it's called CRISPR-Cas9. It's these two kind of things that come together that allow for the editing of DNA. And so scientists realized the amount of power and how amount of scientific advancements that could occur if we could use this CRISPR-Cas9 system to edit DNA. Mm-hmm. And that sounds scary, and we'll get into a little bit more about that. But at its kind of basic is that it can really help us study genetic variants because we can now experimentally edit DNA. For example, let's go back to our idea here. Like, we have two species that diverged recently and they have this different phenotype. And we think that it is a genetic change in this one gene, this one protein coding. We think it's this that explains the variation in the phenotype. What we can do is we can take this organism, let's say the one that has phenotype A, and we have phenotype B. We could take an individual that has phenotype A, and we could actually use CRISPR to edit the gene in this individual to have the genetic variant that we see in phenotype B. So we can basically test whether this genetic change drives the phenotype for B. Because what we can do is we can take the genetic background of phenotype A and we can make one change using CRISPR. And then we can see if that now results in phenotype B. And if it does, we have pretty good evidence that that genetic change is what actually drives this phenotype change. And so it allows us to like confirm our hypotheses or provide evidence of our hypotheses of what is the genetics of these different phenotypes. For example, or what is local adaptation? Or what are these things? Bringing back to our first segment, DNA is very big. Mm-hmm. And even though there's only 0.1% of variation, that's a lot of different variants. And so there can be a lot of different variants between these two phenotypes. And we can use different techniques to figure out what we might think is the variant driving this phenotype difference. But being able to confirm that or test things with genetic changes is really powerful. So that's one of the ways that we can use CRISPR-Cas9 system is to do targeted genetic changes. However, that creates a whole host of ideas about ethics and enhancement and various things, because hypothetically, we could use this to alter individuals. We could use it to change people's DNA sequence.
Right. Before we get into the ethical portion of this, there is the aspect that there are wonderful applications to this without even approaching an ethical conversation. What kind of applications might that be, just for someone who's not familiar with CRISPR?
Yeah. So CRISPR is the system in and of itself, and it's fascinating in and of itself. But really what we can do with it is of interest with people. So we can do genome editing. So an example that I see here is, like, for example, something like sickle cell anemia. So sickle cell anemia is a mutation in the genome that results in your blood cells having this sickle shape.
Right.
And so that sickle shape doesn't transport oxygen, can make people very, very sick.
Yes.
And so that is a mutation that happens in a protein coding region of the genome that breaks something. It's a loss of function. I'm pretty sure that that's, anyways, is a mutation that occurs. Using CRISPR, you can introduce a functional protein. So you can basically edit the genome so that it no longer has the protein copy that has the broken version. You can basically find and replace, command F and replace that region of the genome with a functional product. That being said, as we were talking about earlier, you have trillions of cells. So once you are a full-fledged adult, you have developed, you're out in the world, you have lots and lots of cells. So the challenge becomes, how do we edit the DNA in all of those cells? How do we try to get that information into all of your cells? It's a lot. And then we're still working on that kind of challenge. But the thing is that, for example, something with sickle cell anemia, you don't have to actually target all of the cells. It turns out there's actually kind of a threshold amount that you can target. And I believe that they're targeting a certain section of your cells so that it can copy. And it, when they copy, that information gets put into all of the, like, daughter cells. And there is kind of a threshold where not every single one of your cells has to be edited for you to be treated for sickle cell anemia. There just has to be a certain amount that they're able to do. And so in that space, CRISPR has the ability to be incredibly powerful to treat disease.
Yeah.
And that is treatment of somatic cells. So that is not germline. It's not going to be passed on to the next generation. It is just treatment of an individual. And it is a way of potentially treating a genetic disease at the source rather than treating the outcome of the disease. And so it's incredibly powerful in that space, and has the ability to change people's lives in that area if it's within generation of a genetic disease.
Right, right. And then what needs to be carefully examined moving forward is then the germ cell germline aspect of
and
the
germline also, aspect. Also genetic modification of individuals. The kind of line is, are we treating a genetic disease or is it enhancement?
Yes.
So
agreed.
There's a pretty firm line that gene editing as a whole should not be used for enhancement. For treatment of disease, we can and we should. That being said, really generally it's into germline, because then that would be changing someone's genetics that gets now passed on to the next generation. So it wouldn't be just treating of an individual of their disease state. This would be like influencing evolution and influencing reproduction. Mm-hmm. And that starts to get into some pretty not so great conversations about ethics and right and wrong and what we should be messing with and what we shouldn't be messing with.
Right. Like, as you said earlier, I mean, the expression of certain characteristics can involve many genes. Mm-hmm. And whenever you're attacking germline, you know, it could end up that maybe we don't fully understand something and then something bad happens, you know, and now it could potentially be carried because you don't want to tell them, oh, well, you can't have offspring because we've tickled with your germline.
Well, that's unethical. That's not even, we just wouldn't know potentially the downstream ramifications. And it also is just, will open the gates of a potentially very slippery slope of what becomes treatment of disease and what becomes enhancement in eugenics and various things. And so it's really that as soon as we open that door of we are able to alter genetic sequence that can be inherited into next generations, it's a slippery slope of what we would consider okay and not okay. The general consensus is that maybe it's just not a slope that we should get on at all. This is just not the hill we want to be on.
Like, definitely not.
Using it to treat a genetic disease within the lifetime of an individual, that has incredible power and ability to change people's lives and be used as a therapeutic treatment. When we start getting into the idea of genetic changes for reproduction that could affect offspring in that space, that starts to open some kind of doors and thoughts that is just deeply not ethical.
Those issues of eugenics, there's the issues of socioeconomics, there's the issues of geopolitics.
There's also like conversations about the access to these kind of treatments, the access to this. And that is actually a conversation about ethics, about even CRISPR used as a therapeutic tool, because it's still quite expensive. And like, how are we going to allow that this is available to everybody? I can't say that I'm an expert in that in any way, shape or form, so I won't really weigh into it. But from a gene editing standpoint, I think that if we start playing God, it becomes difficult. Experiments like this have been shut down already.
It was a group of Chinese researchers that were messing around with germline, and they were trying to treat a disease, like a legitimate disease that everybody would go, oh yeah, that's a disease to treat, but it was shut down by like no journals would publish it, and the science community just kind of was like, no. No.
Yeah, because like the thing is that like, I mean, it is an interesting conversation about ethics because it's a disease state. We could cure this. We could do it. But it just really opens up the ability if we start altering in germlines for conversations about designer babies. And it's just not a space that currently or probably ever we really would want to explore. But from a CRISPR, from a research perspective of being able to test hypotheses about genetic mutations and what they mean and how that looks for evolution and also for therapeutics of treatment within the lifetime of someone. I mean, there's a reason why it won the Nobel Prize quite recently, like very recently, just was so exciting for us. From that aspect, CRISPR is so freaking cool. But we do have to be careful about the potential for it to be misused.
Devil's advocate. This is the doppelganger of Sam. Do you think there could ever be a point in which we do have a geopolitical standpoint where we say there are these 20 diseases that we would like to eradicate, and we have the technology now? We don't have the technology now based on what I've read or what I've heard. But if we had the technology and we had the geopolitical agreement on a set of diseases, then would it be acceptable to move forward?
I think it's interesting because when we think of different types of diseases, so for example, if we were very clear about like what they are caused by, so let's say it's a mutation that is a loss of function mutation. So it breaks the protein in this area and that causes disease state. I still don't believe that maybe this will be thousands of years in the future when we've done more and more research because biology is incredibly complex and it's messy, interacts with the environment. And it's just, I don't think in our current understanding that this is something that we want to open. I don't think it's something that we have the knowledge about to confidently say we are only going to eradicate these diseases and there will be no other consequences to this. Our understanding of how genes work, and I don't want to like make it sound like we don't have any idea of what's going on, just it's so complex and mm-hmm. we understand a lot about how genes work and their interactive effect and into environment, but there's still so much we don't know. And so I think that if we started looking at that space and making that mm-hmm. a possibility, I just don't think currently we have the ability to confidently say that by altering these things, we would just eradicate this disease without there being any other consequences. Yep. And I also just think that that is morally or ethically, I don't know. It's an interesting one. It's an interesting because obviously don't want people to suffer and want people to be genetically healthy. But I do think that if we could focus more on the treatment of individuals within their lifetime so that in individual, when this crops up and when they can be treated for it in that aspect, that eliminates some of these ethical and moral concerns and still allows for individuals to be treated and to have a high quality of life and not to suffer in ways that they don't have to. So I think that the focus probably being on within generation treatment and therapeutics is just probably a better focus.
I agree. My response would be that, and that just like how obviously this is a very, very far parallel example, but there's companies that are interested in developing ways of artificial intelligence, like ethics. And so for me, it should be a private effort, but it should be a political and a geopolitical effort to instill committees or companies that delegate the regulation of our ethical concerns that we're bringing up here.
Yeah, there has to be legislation. There needs to be governing bodies that are able to like keep things in check.
Yeah. I think it's way more important. Obviously, it's really important to cure people, but like to work in tandem in that manner is just so important.
But it's a fascinating conversation and it's an important one to consider. And you know, CRISPR, and I think it's also important to talk about, maybe if you don't mind, about some of the limitations about CRISPR, because I've seen a lot of like misinformation and people posting photos of like a chicken with wings, with like dog legs, and being like, CRISPR, not possible. Even if you put the dog leg components of the genome, which don't exist because it's, again, this complex regulation of on and off. One, you would have to do this at the embryo stage. That you would have to do. Talking about this very hypothetical situation that cannot exist. You would have to do that. Like, you would have to take the DNA of a chicken and the DNA of a dog, and you'd have to put it together and then make this, or it just wouldn't survive. It wouldn't even replicate to make multi-cells. It would just not make it, because these are very divergent genomes. The machinery wouldn't understand the instructions. Nothing would make sense. And it would go, I'm going home. I quit. And it just wouldn't work. And so when you see things like that, of like being like, we've melded these things together and all this, no, they haven't. That's not how CRISPR works. And it's not how gene editing can work. Like there has to be a lot of like compatibility, making sure that when you're doing like, you're moving a gene from two very closely related species or like ecotypes of the same species, that moving this one gene and putting it in that doesn't disrupt things that are vital for survival. And that's between species that are very similar. And you're talking about a single gene. If you just mashed a dog and a chicken genome together, it just wouldn't work. It biologically can't exist. And so I just have seen that a few times actually on TikTok. I've been tagged in videos where people are like, can this happen? I'm like, no,
not even close.
Not even close.
I think a good layman perspective is that the genome of a Homo sapien and the genome of like an orangutan is like, what, 1% difference? Maybe I'm probably under-exaggerating that by a little bit, but we obviously can't breed with them.
Yeah.
And that's 1%, but like between you and I, it's like 0.1%, right? Imagine a dog and a cat. Like, do you ever see a dog come from a cat? No, because it's
So imagine if you were trying to just like artificially mash those genomes together using CRISPR. One, it just doesn't work like that in general, but there's just no way for that to happen. If you're ever tagged or if you ever see a video come across your For You page and it's got a dog with chicken wings on it, it's just Photoshop. Or someone has taken their poor pooch and glued some chicken wings on it. And the dog's going, I don't think I want to be part of this. So it's not genetics. It's nothing like that. We're not there yet. And we're never going to be there because it's...
You just can't do it.
Like that. No.
So I want to open the floor to you, Brenna. Do you have anything else that you want to talk about before we get on out of here?
You know, I can't think of it. It's been a wonderful conversation to be talking to you about this, about something that I love. We really covered a whole bunch to be able to go from, you know, what is DNA to talking about CRISPR. Is there anything that I'm going to flip it around on you? Anything do you think that I was unclear about that I could help better explain, go over again, or anything like that?
Not from my point of view. I'm sure that I'm gonna point into a different direction. I guess we're playing ping pong. but instead it's a third party ping pong serve. Mm-hmm. So if anybody does have any questions for you from this podcast, how could they reach out to you?
Yeah. Gosh. Well, I mean, I do have a TikTok account. I believe it's Biology Bren. I'm not particularly active on there right now. I am hoping to come back to it. Turns out finishing your PhD is a lot, and I just haven't had a lot. But if there's specific questions that anybody has, sending me a message on there, and I would happily make a video about it or answer. I have a website. You can contact me through that as well. Read my papers. just plugging my papers, please. So really, I would say those kind of two major ways with my website and my TikTok. There's some videos still on there about evolution. And for example, like I made a video a while back about whether we actually share 60% of our DNA with a banana. Talk about what that actually means. Spoiler, we kind of do. We don't really.
It's complicated.
Turns out it's a specific part of the DNA. So I'd say that those are probably like two ways the best, and I'll try to answer any questions. I was the most responsive on TikTok, but I am trying to get better because I do love that part of communicating science. Yeah.
Well, I think that is a good way to end the podcast. That way that they can be like, oh, fresh in my head. Go talk to her. Okay. Yeah. So, sweet. Brenna, thanks a bunch for being on the podcast. This was
Thank you for
wonderful.
Having me. This has been absolutely delightful.
And that concludes this episode of Everything STEAM. I just wanted to take a quick second and thank Brenna for sharing her knowledge and expertise about, you guessed it, genetics and, of course, CRISPR. To follow Brenna and her work, I suggest that you visit her website, brennastanford.weebly.com. I would also love to mention my amazing team for their collective efforts to make the show happen. This podcast was edited by Ariel Piermont, QC'd by Panipit Erickson, and the episode art was created by Gabrielle Edmiston. After the episode, please give our podcast a rating and review on whatever platform you get your podcasts on. We're always looking for feedback, and the rating would greatly help us out in the fight against the algorithms. Lastly, be sure to check us out on all the socials for podcast news, upcoming episodes, and fun STEAM content. Just search Everything STEAM on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook to join in on the fun. Once again, thank you for listening to Everything STEAM. I'm your host, Sam Stanford, and as always, stay curious.
Everything STEAM would like to give a shout out to Anchor by Spotify for sponsoring our podcast along with Ben Sound Music for providing our show with intro, outro, and advertisement background rhythm.